Hello and welcome to Science Set Free, a series of podcasts with myself, Mark Vernon, and Rupert Sheldrake. Hello, Rupert.
Hello, Mark.
Now, Rupert, I wonder whether we might do a big picture discussion today, because I've just been doing a series of talks about the history of Christianity. It's for an organisation called the Idler Academy that I do quite a lot of work with, and we've called it A History of Christianity in 11 Short Chapters. And what I tried to do was go to the kind of, try and capture the essence or the spirit of Christianity. And I felt that it's maybe quite a good time to do that because although Christianity in many parts of the world is sort of booming, there's also quite a powerful sense of other religions, a more plural world, and even a bit of a post-Christian world, sometimes it's said. So whilst some people, you know, find that a bit distressing, it also provides a sort of freedom to look at Christianity a bit more, with a bit more distance, perhaps, you know, when it's not Christendom anymore, where it's just kind of all around us, we're immersed in it, you can't take a step back. You can take a step back now. So I've been trying to think about, you know, what makes for the essence of Christianity. A bit like, you know, people are asking what's the essence of Buddhism as it comes into the West.
Yes.
The freedom from the kind of cultural accretions actually provides an opportunity to think again. So I wondered about talking about that and, yeah, what really is at the heart of Christianity?
Oh, yes. I think that's very interesting. So,
yeah,
please.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, what I try to do is land on some key figures, you know, hence the 11 short chapters, who I think, really give, weight to a series of ideas or experiences of life, really, a kind of spirit that, has become part of our, you know, psychic, emotional kind of household. It's become part of who we think we are as human beings. So, for example, we begin with St. Paul in the series, and he's often portrayed in a rather dark, manipulative light now, as if he somehow ruined the message of Jesus to turn it into a thing that Jesus never intended. But I think Paul was really onto something that had been around in the Roman Empire, but he does this fascinating thing with it. And it's the notion of cosmopolitanism, the idea that we're primarily citizens of the universe, you know, and cosmopolitan, rather than, say, tied to our particular city-state or to our family and kin. But whereas the Romans had had an empire, so they'd had developed a kind of cosmopolis, he gives it this extra twist, which is that rather than being sort of top-down, rather elite, hierarchical setup, he goes from the bottom up and really emphasizes the value of the individual in all this, the person. You know, so one of his most famous remarks in his letters are that in Christ there's no slave or free, Jew or Greek, male or female. Now this takes a long time to actually become manifest, but nonetheless there's a driving spirit there that seems to pay attention to the individual and the person. And you know, that is now something which we take for granted, that the person, the individual matters. And not just the individual matters in terms of rights, but that being a person, what it is to have a kind of individuality, a character, you know, the integrity, the authenticity of being a person, you might say. We sort of feel that must matter somehow. And I think that Paul, you know, latches onto this and really tries to develop that with all his ups and downs and all the failures of the local churches he tried to get going. I don't know if that makes some sense to you.
Well, I think it does. I mean, there's something about the whole of modern Western culture, which is, you know, about the value of individuals and human rights, which one could say were a kind of late flowering of that very second centuries, millennia, for that to reach through. But human rights are not obvious. They weren't obvious to the Romans. Slaves had no rights. Slave owners had lots of rights, but slaves didn't. In the United States, in the early 19th century, in the South, slaves had no rights. Even though the United States was a free country based on the Declaration of Independence, you know, serfs had very few rights in Russia in the early 19th century. And so the idea that everyone has equal rights, which is in the UN Declaration of Human Rights, is not part of most traditional cultures. And yet, the seeds are definitely there in early Christianity. I don't know whether they're there in a similar way in early Buddhism, which was an attempt to overcome the limitations of caste. But that was really an attempt to overcome not just restrictions on human rights in society, but to liberate oneself entirely from the human condition or the condition of nature.
Yeah, I mean, I think it must link to this axial movement, as it's sometimes put, with figures like the Buddha, who do a kind of inward turn in spiritual practice. So, instead of being preoccupied with things like caste, social status, and then also sacrifice and rituals that, as it were, try to affect things from the outside in the axial movement, the Buddha, Confucius, I think Socrates too in ancient Greece, there's a kind of inward out move that you work on the inside. I think that Jesus must be part of that. It's sort of probably three or four centuries on. At that point, maybe this is extra a notion of the person as well. That somehow your individual relationship in Christianity to God kind of matters as well. There's a kind of, it feels like there's a further development of it that leads to what we think of being a person now.
Yes, I mean, it certainly seems to be part of that, doesn't it? And the fact that Jesus had this great tension with both the Jewish and the Roman authorities, the temple authorities and the political authorities, were both very suspicious of this because it went against their system, which is much more collective and authoritarian. But there seems to be an inbuilt tension even in St. Paul, because where St. Paul talks about it, it's not that he's glorifying the individual with all the individual's quirks. He talks about not I, but Christ within me. So the idea is that it's not me, Rupert, or you, Mark, with our there's not a supreme importance to my idiosyncrasies or your idiosyncrasies, but our capacity to become filled with the Spirit of Christ, which is not our own personal idiosyncrasies, can work through us and in us, but is basically going beyond us. And the same is true in early Buddhism, and indeed in the Upanishads, in the ancient rishis of India. It's not a matter about cultivating individual personality, like celebrity-type personality features, but rather that which goes beyond individual personality.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And again, you could say that perhaps celebrity and the fascination with, as you say, the individual's idiosyncrasies, the fascination with that is a kind of corruption of the deeper message. And I love that remark about Paul, that I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. And I think that's another thing which Paul really got, is that the meaning of the death and resurrection of Jesus wasn't primarily some sort of proof that he was divine, which I think is often how it's taken today. It was more that this is an individual path of death and rebirth that we could go on ourselves to discover a completely new dimension to life. Our life can be grounded, as you say, in a sense of aliveness, personhood, engagement, that actually shed the idiosyncrasies, ups and downs, and so has that much more expansive kind of feel.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that if that's true about Paul, then I think another key figure is Augustine in this. Again, a complicated figure, as you say, a lot of inner tensions, because he became both a bishop and had to manage an organization and so on, an institution, a few centuries after Paul. But nonetheless, he writes this book, Confessions, which is sometimes called the first autobiography in the West, where you have this tremendous sense of an individual struggling with their flaws, and their difficulties, but trying to reach out to what is more than just the immediate ups and downs of his life. So one of his most famous comments is, make me chaste, but not yet. And you have that sense of he's wanting to be free of his individual desires and even lusts, which he knows are so powerful, but yet somehow so limiting. And yet at the same time, he's like, but I don't know how to give it up too, not yet. It feels very modern in that way somehow.
Yes.
Yeah.
I suppose that the other thing that was going on at that time was the growth of early monasticism, where you had people like Saint Anthony in the desert, where there was a whole movement of Christians retiring from the world as monks or hermits, more like hermits to start with, and then wrestling with their inner demons, which I suppose were things like sexual fantasies, among other things. And I suppose that when that must have given a kind of internal, personal turn to the whole thing, because if you're a hermit in the desert, you're not part of the urban sort of temple worship scene, which is a much more collective scene. I mean, these are literal physical withdrawals from the collective.
Yeah. Desert. I mean, for me, a really key figure in that part of the development of early Christianity, which, you know, in the third century or so, is this figure, Evagrius Ponticus, who was a desert father about the same time as St. Anthony. And he develops a kind of inner map of the demons, as they put it, but as you, I think we would perhaps more naturally say, of the kind of really uncomfortable experiences and parts of us that we if we had choice, we would sort of expel somehow, a bit like demons being cast out, which is what became the seven deadly sins. But to my mind, again, that's a horrible kind of way of putting it, because what he's saying is not if you experience lust, if you experience gluttony, if you experience pride, it's not that you are going to be somehow lost forever. He's saying you will experience these things if you sit still, if you turn inwards, that you will find them there. And the question is, what do you do next? How can you tolerate them? And he comes up with a number of ways of sort of holding them, antidotes to them, ways of even going into them to explore them more deeply, so that, as it were, there's an energy that is actually of value to you on the other side of the pure lust or the pure pride. And that does feel very much like what people are nowadays discovering in Buddhist psychology, actually. The kind of tantra approach, where you try to hold what, if it had free rein, would ruin you, but to try and see that the demon, as it were, can become a god, or that which is destructive actually can become very creative through various practices and techniques.
Yes.
And I do actually understand that there probably were Buddhist communities in Egypt where these desert mothers and fathers went. Whether or not there was much cross-fertilization or not, I don't know. But I certainly feel that people like Evagrius and Anthony were responding to the need to really go in as profoundly as you possibly could to that inner journey, you know, the kind of axial moment.
Yes. So they were trying, it's a bit like Tibetan Buddhists trying to transform wrathful deities to peaceful deities. These qualities which are destructive can be allies if turned around.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So Evagrius, for example, was very drawn to what he called the gift of tears. You know, when you cry, something breaks down, something softens. You feel, as it were, sort of out of control, but not completely as if you're falling apart. It's a very kind of fertile place to be in. And so Anthony saw those kind of psychological moments as ones where, you know, as he would put it, the spirit could come in and remake you. And that, as he puts it, when Jesus talked about the kingdom of God, the kingdom of God is precisely found within. That's where you find it. It's not, as it were, something that primarily is manifest upon earth. It's primarily manifest inside the spirit. And if we can develop that notion of the inner kingdom, then we can know more fully about the promises of the founding figure, Jesus. But it's troubling. It's a very troubling, you know. Another one of the bits of Jesus is saying that he really likes is Jesus's notion that the kingdom of God comes like a thief in the night, which is really quite disturbing, almost nightmarish kind of image if you really think about it. You know, being broken into. And my sense is that he liked these sayings of Jesus because that is what this journey's like. You know, there is the promise of becoming fully human, life in all its fullness. And that, you know, tremendously rich sense of individuality that shares in the transcendent too. But it's a tricky path to go on, you know, like Augustine with his confessions, sort of wringing his hands and crying out, as it were.
Mm.
But feels very much part of, you know, our kind of Western experience, you know, whether it be Dark Nights of the Soul or Midlife Crises or,
yes,
you know, yeah.
Yes, and all these things about, you know, psychoanalysis and psychotherapy and stuff, they're all carrying forward that kind of thing, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, I very much buy Jung's line on this, where he made the observation that psychotherapy emerges in the 19th and 20th century because this Christian resource had sort of broken down, maybe it was at the dissolution of the monasteries in Europe, where the practitioners of this inner life, the wisdom was kind of held, that was wiped out in a generation. And maybe too, Christianity, which has always had a tendency to be quite extrovert, I think, you know, to become caught up with empire. Certainly in Britain, you know, where we live, the British Empire, Church of England, became the sort of church to a quarter of the world, you might say. And something gets lost if that happens, I'm sure. But I think psychotherapy must be a kind of reinvention. And in British psychotherapy, figures like Melanie Klein and Donald Winnicott, they start getting very interested in things like envy and hate and how that can live alongside creativity and love. Mm. And it does feel like a re-exploration of Evagrius's work on lust and greed and pride.
But in any religion, there's a tension between this kind of inner life and the more collective social functions. So, for example, in Hinduism, you have the people who pursue the inner spiritual journey, the sannyasins, who are like monks. You know, they're wandering holy men, they live in caves, they meditate in forests, they go on pilgrimages to Mount Kailash and so forth. I mean, there's the wandering holy men is one key feature of Hinduism, which in a sense is in the tradition of the rishis, the seers, the people who gave us the Upanishads and these great spiritual insights. But on the other hand, there's temple worship and there's the Brahmins, who are the priests. And people don't expect Brahmin priests to be great spiritual teachers. They're temple officials who carry out the correct rituals at the correct times in the correct way, in Sanskrit, and are educated in it and learn how to chant it and memorize whole passages by heart. They're playing a completely different role, and no one in India would expect, you know, a wandering sannyasin to take on the role of a temple priest and know all the right mantras in Sanskrit and the right chants. And vice versa, no one would expect, well, some temple priests may become sannyasins, but it's a different role. And in Christianity, after it took on this imperial collective form through the conversion of Constantine and became the official religion of the Roman Empire, then there were all these temples and churches and cathedrals and so on, and then priests who become part of a hierarchy serving the temples and carrying out the correct rituals, which is a different track, really. It's complementary, it's more collective, it's to do things that every society needs: collective celebrations, collective festivals, singing together, chanting together, things that cause social cohesion, which in a way is always in tension with this more individual exploration. And that tension was there in the life of Jesus. Jesus took part in the temple rituals. He went on pilgrimage to Jerusalem for the Passover and for other festivals. He taught in the temple. He was part of that tradition. He taught in synagogues. And yet, he was going beyond it, creating a tremendous tension with that. And in a sense, that's endured ever since. And as you say, the suppression of the monasteries in the Protestant countries, not in the Catholic or Orthodox countries, but in the Protestant countries, removed this resource of specialists in contemplation and spirituality. And
yeah, I love that distinction that, as you say, in Indian religion you find that the spiritual wisdom is with the non-Brahmin caste so often. You know, so like Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita is a warrior, You know, it's not a Brahmin, and I'd love it if Christianity could recover more of that sense. It's very striking that a lot of the key figures in Christianity got into trouble with the authorities before their teachings were more widely accepted. So Evagrius was declared a heretic. He got caught up in after his death, not during his life, but afterwards people started to perceive him as a Gnostic, and he got caught up in some of the Gnostic controversies. Augustine himself, you know, was a follower of Plato and a Manichaean and so on for a lot of his life, and only quite lately in a way became a Christian. And I'm sure that plurality of his experience is part of what makes him such an amazing person to read now. Mm. And Thomas Aquinas, you know, probably the greatest philosopher theologian in Western Christianity anyway, he became a Dominican. And they were the kind of rebel friars of the medieval world who stood against, along with the Franciscans, yes. who stood against the excesses of Rome and all that. Mm. You know, it was so shocking when he became a Dominican that his brothers locked him in a tower for 2 years to try to put him off. Mm. And then he engaged with Islam. He went to the University of Naples, which was a new university at the time, and being in southern Italy, was very exposed to Islam, where he discovered Aristotle. You know, so he was right on the edge of what was acceptable. And again, his books were often banned. They were banned in Oxford and Paris for a while anyway. So that sort of sense that the charism of a great tradition exists in a tension with those who do the more collective side and hold it together.
Yes.
Is really important, actually.
Yes, well, I mean, I think presumably the history of Christianity, like the history of other religions, involves a tension between these. In Islam, there's a tension between the kind of rather orthodox mullahs and Quranic teachings of the kind of Wahhabi type, you know, very strict puritanical teachings, and Sufis, who are much freer and much more about the kind of inspiration of the spirit. And again, they too have been persecuted over the centuries. And yeah. regarded as heretics.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, we both know someone who's a kind of a Muslim teacher, I guess, but who's not a kind of formal cleric at the same time.
Yes.
Moaz in Egypt. And
yes.
There seems to be a place for that kind of ministry, you might say, or possibility or voice.
Yes.
That it's quite hard to find in Christianity. Which has become very clericalized, I suppose.
Well, there are, of course, examples, but they're mostly, some of them at least, at least in the Catholic world, from the monastic tradition, like Thomas Merton, who was a contemplative monk who had quite a wide influence through his books.
And yeah, that's true. Yeah.
My own teacher, Father Bede Griffiths, who was a Benedictine monk living in an ashram in India, who, again, had a somewhat ambiguous relationship to the Roman Catholic hierarchy. You know, some loved what he was doing and others were deeply suspicious of it. I think this is true within any tradition. I mean, if you look at science, science is now a massive institutional structure that has all the traits of intolerance and dogmatism that we associate with, you know, some of the worst aspects of religion. And yet, it's renewed by people who are often treated as heretics.
Yeah.
So it may be just built into the human condition that there's this kind of interplay between these approaches.
I also wonder whether probably the fastest growing form of Christianity now, Pentecostalism, is in a way a sort of rebellion against an overbearing orthodoxy. Because it's often remarked that it's not just the fastest growing branch of Christianity, but is also growing fast amongst poorer people. You know, it springs up and it kind of comes out of, you know, from the bottom up. And now, I mean, I don't want to idealize it. I'm sure it's got its problems as well. But nonetheless, it's almost as if, certainly in the West, Christianity, this tension is shifting again, you might say. It's kind of turning again. Maybe the individual teacher, you know, like a Thomas Merton or a Richard Rohr is someone who's still working our life today that I find doing that kind of work too. and then maybe also in these sort of more mass kind of popular movements. I don't know, figure that the last chapter in our series that we looked at is actually Oprah Winfrey. She, you know, is as much a spiritual teacher as she is a philanthropist, as she is a media owner. I think she helps propagate a kind of Christianity that you know, engages with the tradition, but is also quite free of the tradition as well. So maybe she, you know, she's a more, I suppose, starry celebrity kind of figure, but maybe could claim to be in that, this tradition of the teacher as well.
But in the Protestant tradition of the teacher.
Yeah,
Because, I mean, I'm sure you've got a chapter on the Reformation in your book.
Yeah, we look at Martin Luther.
We probably won't have time to discuss now, but there's this breaking off from the rather the hierarchical institutional church, which is more, well, Martin Luther was a monk, and so there was a sense in which there was an attempt to go back to the more individual accountability, etc. But then, of course, Protestant churches reinvented institutions of their own, the Lutheran Church, the Church of England, the Calvinist churches, the Presbyterian churches. They all have their own different structures, but they're still structures. And I think that, you know, one of the things that, at least that I find, is that there is a kind of human need for both these things. We need a communal way of expressing celebrations. I mean, it's wonderful when you go to a culture like Bali or India where the popular festivals are still popular, or parts of Italy, where everyone joins in. And we still have a residue of that in Christmas and to a lesser extent Easter. But we don't have many popular festivals where everyone can get together and join in with an explicit spiritual goal or mythological foundation.
Yeah.
So I think we need that. And I think the idea of a parish church is at the centre of a community where people can meet regularly to sing together and give thanks to God. I really like that aspect of the Christian tradition. But it seems to me that it's not necessarily contradictory, but complementary to the more individual pursuit of a spiritual path.
Yeah, and both of us are fans of choral evensong. You know, we were just in Westminster Abbey last week, where you can, as an individual, walk in to this place, which is astonishing in itself, but listen to this incredibly beautiful music that is performed to the, you know, the height of excellence. It really is quite fantastic. And yet, it takes a whole institution to sustain that. You've got to have the both and.
Yes, I mean that, and to maintain the building. I mean, these great cathedrals, someone has to mend the roof and heat them and look after the structure and insure them and have the stonework repaired and repair breaks in the stained glass windows. All that requires a whole institutional framework. It can't be done by kind of individual meditators or mystics. I mean, you have to have a structure to maintain these. Just as in the ancient world you had to have a structure to maintain the temples, or in India today. And that's a priestly hierarchy that does that. That's their job. And I'm glad they do it.
But maybe we're in a time where we need to reconnect and celebrate the more, the bottom-up, the individual spiritual teacher, trying to recover some of the charism that has, you know, driven Christianity, and Christianity helps develop. And, maybe that's, you know, hopefully that's part of what we've been talking about.
Exactly. I don't think we can go much further today, but I think it's a really important point, and I think we can see this tension going right the way through, and certainly going back to Jesus and St. Paul.
Well, maybe if I could just give a final plug for these talks, which are on the Idler website and the Idler Academy website, and they're called A History of Christianity in 11 Short Chapters, trying to recover some of the spirit of it and how it impacts us now.
Very good, Mark.
Thanks very much, Rupert.
Thank you.